Every Friday at this time, we hear from StoryCorps, the project that brings together friends and families to record their stories. They talk with each other. They ask the questions of each other. 75-year-old Julian Walker wanted to remember his father, who grew up in a farming town north of Wilmington, North Carolina. When Julian's dad was 5 years old, his life changed. He suffered a serious accident.
My father fell off a cart they pull heavy logs out of the forest with, and the cart ran over him. He was just severely injured. And as an old man, he still had scars on his head where his scalp was rolled back. He was just scalped. The only medical facility they had up in the town was an old Dr. Shaw, and he did what he could to patch my father up, which was not much. So he was sent to Wilmington to the hospital. He had to live there and have special care, and a family befriended him and took him in. I'm going to jump forward 75 years. And he was an old man. He sat in his chair on the front lawn under the oak trees. This one day he was sitting there, and an elderly couple came to the house, and the woman was a Mrs. Marshall, and she and my mother were friends. They went into the house, and Mr. Marshall sat out there with us, and my dad asked him, where was he from? And Mr. Marshall says, well, I've lived in Wilmington all my life. And my dad said, you know, when I was a kid, I was injured, and a family took me in. I do not know their names or anything about them. I just remember they had other children. Mr. Marshall said, do you remember a teenage boy that used to carry you on his shoulders? That was me. I noticed my father looked to the northeast. Mr. Marshall looked to the southeast, and I saw a tear run down their faces. I felt like I was invading somebody's privacy. So I quickly left, and I let them have their moment. It was hard for me to see for a little while either. But I can look back and see the depth of memories between these two old men. My daddy wasn't a real emotional man, and he didn't dwell on those things. So I never knew of this family until I heard the conversation. And, you know, to hear that made me know that there was a lot of things about my father that I didn't know.
That's Julian Walker talking with his daughter, Julia Walker Jewell, in Wilmington, North Carolina. Their conversation will be archived with all StoryCorps interviews at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. And as always, you can get the podcast at NPR.org. A town in northern Vermont is celebrated as the scene of a local food revival. Small farms are multiplying around this town, which is called Hardwick. The hard part, though, is making that local food cheap or convenient enough for local people to eat it. They're working on that, and Dan Charles has our report.
Ben Hewitt, as much as anyone, made Hardwick famous. He's a writer. He lives down the road from Hardwick, and what he saw happening there struck him as unusual, even odd.
Here's this town, you know, unemployment rate 40% higher than the Vermont state average, median income 25% lower. And then there was this thing happening around, so-called sustainable agriculture and local food.
This thing was lots of small farms starting up. One local farmer claims the area around town has more organic farms per capita than anywhere else in the world. Also a thriving local grocery co-op, a busy farmer's market, even a classy restaurant where almost anything you eat grew or grazed on land nearby. So Hewitt wrote a book about Hardwick, The Town That Food Saved. At the local high school, Hayes and Union, some students in senior-level English classes have been reading and discussing that book as a class assignment. And they don't like it very much. They don't think Hewitt told the whole story. Derek Demers, for instance.
He only covers one side of the town. There's the side of the town that is for this local food movement, but there's, I think, even a greater side of the town with more people that can't afford the local food movement. I work at our local supermarket grocery store, and I see most of the people in the town there.
That supermarket food is shipped in from far away, but it's mostly cheaper than the local squash and greens and tomatoes on sale at the town co-op. Ricky Weatherall says that's why people go to big chain supermarkets in Hardwick and everywhere.
I feel like the whole world is sort of moving towards even more, not local.
But at the same time, awareness is going up so much lately, especially around our area. So there's two sides to this food thing, and both of which seem to be growing. So
yeah, I totally agree with that.
The students point out that some of their town's successful local farms are selling high-priced cheese and organic tofu in places like Boston and New York. It's not really for the locals. Senior Morgan Warden.
And it's not that people don't want to eat healthy, because they certainly see the benefits of eating locally and healthily, but we just simply don't have the money to do so, and that's the sad thing.
But this is not the end of the story, because some people in Hardwick are trying to change that and make the town's local food everybody's food. Pete Johnson, for instance, he owns one of the biggest organic farms in the area, Pete's Greens. From the roadside above his farm, you see 7 greenhouses lined up side by side. Beyond them lie 50 acres of fields with crops just emerging from brown soil.
You know, some of this food has been kind of fancy and on the fringes and perhaps a bit overpriced because the efficiencies of production are low. I mean, a lot of these farms, our farm is small and it's really diversified, which means that we're not particularly efficient at raising anything.
So Johnson is moving his farm a little bit in the industrial direction, trying to get bigger and more efficient.
You want to see our new infrastructure briefly?
Love to see it.
He rolls up a door at one end of the greenhouse, and suddenly we're looking at a giant construction site.
We had a barn fire here this winter, and so now we're rebuilding our facility. And we're doing things like building a very large freezer.
That's to store his broccoli or berries to sell at markets all winter. He's buying equipment that will cut and wash vegetables, puree squash, anything to make it more convenient for busy people.
That's really a key part of reaching a bigger group. And what's the point of doing this if we're only reaching the 7% who are already converted, you know?
Johnson says he wants people to rely on local food and local farmers for all kinds of reasons.
For me, one of the biggest ones is the cultural aspects. You know, these hills used to be populated by small farms, just cluttered with small farms everywhere. And now, I mean, even with this resurgence we have going on, we don't have the culture that we used to have.
A culture where everybody knows a farmer and knows what it takes to grow food.
When I graduated from college in 1997, and I told my friends I was going to be a vegetable farmer, that there was no response. It was just like, they didn't know where to go with that, you know? And now I tell people what I do, and everybody has some story to connect to it and is excited about it. And young folks, more and more of them want to stay here. They see being involved in one of these businesses or starting their own as an exciting future.
Even managers at the 2 local supermarkets in Hardwick are now trying to put a few more local vegetables on their shelves. Lynn Delarichelier at the Grand Union supermarket says her corporate supervisors took some convincing.
But they're understanding now. Once you make them see and they actually come to this town and realize how important it is, it's going to happen.
Do you have any concerns?
No, I want local. The more the better.
What got you interested in doing this?
The people. It's the first question they ask. Where's the corn from? Where's the lettuce from? Where are the cucumbers from? You know, are they local? This is a town that's different, special.
And that's what you hear from a lot of people in Hardwick.
The community here is so tight, like everybody knows everybody.
Zach Hartling is one of the students I talked to at Hazen Union High School. He moved here from Connecticut, and he still has an outsider's perspective on the place.
So I think that sense of community and knowing, like, where the food's coming from.
Really knowing where it comes from, knowing whose hands harvested it.
That just has a huge impact on the way things work.
The longer these high school students talk, the more they seem to come around to the idea that they and a lot of people in town do participate in local food one way or another.
The farmers market moved this year to the Atkins Field, and it's getting bigger, like it's expanding a lot.
Connie's Kitchen just moved into a bigger location
That's true.
And Connie's Kitchen isn't organic,
but it shows
the growth of this town.
Junior Finn Kane likes to cook. He dreams of opening his own restaurant here.
I think the history of this town has always been, you know, of hard times.
And we persevere.
That's Meg Urey. She lives on a farm. Her mother is growing all the potatoes for meals at Lakewood Elementary School this year.
I feel like it's kind of just one of those places in the world that you have hard times, you have a neighbor, and you help each other out. It's give and take, and it's nice.
Like, I don't think that food has saved Hardwick. I don't think that Hardwick has found the answer.
Derek Demers is the senior who works at the Grand Union supermarket.
But I think that Hardwick is on the right path more so than most other places. I think we're headed in the right direction. We have a great start.
Maybe the same thing can't happen in bigger towns or mega cities. Maybe Hardwick is different. But in this small town, at least, food is moving from the fringes of local life back toward its heart. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
Okay, when the space shuttle Atlantis returns to Earth on July 21st, the shuttle program will end. Retired NASA astronaut Leroy Chow explained what that will mean on All Things Considered.
After this mission, we will no longer have the ability to send American astronauts into space ourselves, and arguably we will no longer be the leaders in human spaceflight until we get that capability back.
Arguably, the leaders in spaceflight will, for now, be Russia. American astronauts will rely solely on the Russian Soyuz spacecraft to reach orbit. After the Cold War rivalry between the Americans and the Soviet Union, this might seem like a time for Russians to feel pride. NPR's David Green says not all Russians see it that way.
Who better than Walter Cronkite to capture those important moments?
On April 12, 1961, 5 days before the Bay of Pigs, American prestige was jolted as the world heard the quickened pulse of Vostok 1 orbiting the Earth. And Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space.
Gagarin got a hero's welcome in Red Square. He had given the Soviets the lead in the space race. 5 decades later, I went to Yuri Gagarin Square in South Moscow to see the towering Yuri Gagarin statue.
People call it the penguin. Because if you look at it, it literally looks like a penguin, you know.
He's holding his arms stretched out like
wings.
Yes,
exactly.
Or something.
So, well, allegedly like wings.
My guide was Yuri Karash, who's studied and written about Russian space policy for years. He remembers how Gagarin's adventure gave citizens this feeling that all their sacrifice for the state was worth it.
America could not do it, okay? Western Europe could not do it. No other country in the world could do it. But the Soviet state could.
Today, though, feels different. Yes, the U.S. shuttle program is ending, and Americans will depend on Russian technology. But many Russians sound melancholy. They believe it won't be long before the U.S. develops a new spacecraft that will beat anything Russia has. Karash captures the sentiment this way. What if a Mercedes broke down in the desert? The driver would find another reliable ride until he got his hands on a new Mercedes.
So you suddenly see a Bedouin riding a camel on the shoulder, and you ask him, hey, guy, do me a favor, give me a lift to some place. And he says, no problem, pay me $63 million and I will take it to you. So does it mean that camel is better than Mercedes?
And if you walk just a few footsteps away from the statue of Yuri Gagarin, and you come to this little mall, it's full of vendors who sell, I'm looking at carpets and hardware. The people who work in this mall walk past the statue of that Soviet space hero coming to work every single day.
Yeah, my name is Igor, and I sell tools here in Gagarin Square.
For 38-year-old Igor Malashkevich, the glory embodied in that statue has faded. On the world stage today, he feels like Russia's weaker than in Soviet times. He said his country needs more respect from the U.S. Maybe he said carrying Americans to space is Russia's opportunity.
I don't think there is something we can be proud of about it, because we are dependent on the states in many other ways, in many respects.
This kind of talk is not uncommon in Russia today. After feeling technologically superior in Soviet times, today some Russians feel their military is in disrepair, scientists are cash-strapped, and the space program has fallen behind. Vera Kunyatsova, who sells kitchen supplies here, was born the year Yuri Gagarin made that first orbit. We were first and could not be beaten, she said. But that was the Soviet Union. She feels her country now lags behind in science and technology. But she added that she's happy her country is no longer feared by the West. And that was the theme yesterday when a new statue of Yuri Gagarin was unveiled. Not in Moscow, but in London, near Buckingham Palace, and right by a statue of the great British explorer James Cook. Sergei Krikalev, who heads Russia's Gagarin Center for Cosmonaut Training, was there for the unveiling, and he said the setting is appropriate.
Captain Cook, who was navigator on Earth, and Gagarin, who was first navigator outside of our planet, are staying looking at each other. I think it's very symbolic.
A symbol, he said, that Russia's no longer a rival to the West, but a friend and a reliable ride into space. David Green, NPR News, Moscow.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, the story of Alicia Martinez. That's not her real name. We're not using it because of her family's fear of deportation. Her story is a case study in the complexities of illegal immigration. Martinez is a U.S. citizen. She was born here. Her parents came to the U.S. illegally from Mexico with her older sister, who was a toddler at the time. In this story from WNYC's Radio Rookies, Alicia reflects on the difficult emotions of growing up in a family that is not supposed to be here.
Zero becomes a 10, so what's 10 minus 9?
It's 1.
Yes. I'm in the living room, helping my 9-year-old cousin with his homework.
8 minus 3.
He was born here, like me, and his parents are illegal, just like mine, but he doesn't know it.
You know what your parents are? Illegal immigrants.
Whenever I hear people using the word illegal, they always emphasize it, as if it's a dirty word. But I'm doing the same with my little cousin.
Was your mom born here?
Mexico?
Yeah. Like my parents, is that they came here without permission.
So without permission?
Yeah. And if the government finds her, they'll put her in jail and then they'll send her back to Mexico.
Don't say that because you're making me cry. Oh.
I know he's probably too young to understand all of this, but I don't want him to find out from kids teasing him at school.
Okay, calm down. Let's do more homework.
I'm almost 17, and we still haven't had a serious family conversation about the fact that my parents and sister are undocumented. That's half my family. What would happen if my parents' job got raided? What would happen to my younger brother, who's autistic? My parents only talk to us seriously about deportation when they try to scare us to do well.
Miami report card.
I'm showing my report card to my mom. I got an 89 average. But she immediately asked what happened to the 95s I used to get. If I don't do well, my mom nags. You better do well in school. Why else did we come here? The government can throw us out. Then, my mom compares me to my older sister, who's always at the top of her class and wants to be a doctor.
Thinking of either being a doctor or a pharmacist.
But she can't even work in the U.S. because she wasn't born here. My mom says I should do even better because I have everything on a silver platter. But piled high on that platter are all these responsibilities. There are a lot of things children of undocumented immigrants have to worry about.
My name is Alexandra.
Like Alex, who's only 13.
As soon as I hit 21, I need to get my parents' papers and everything.
She's the first in the family who can work legally. So when she slacks off at school, her undocumented sister pushes her to do better.
Sometimes I do get really pissed off, like, how bad my sister was doing in school. And it's like, you have all of these opportunities and you're just throwing them away, you know. It's like, she can tell you I was so mad.
My sister and I, well, we've actually never sat down and talked about that.
So you never resented the fact that me, Larry, and Diego are citizens, maybe when you were younger?
I don't know if resent was the word. It was either in junior high or high school where it actually hit me that, you know, I was undocumented and that you guys were citizens. I think I felt some sort of anger towards mom and dad, and just the fact that if they had known the consequences for me because of how my life is now, of the difficulties that I've had.
We live on Staten Island, and there's a lot of tension over illegal immigration. If I'm in my neighborhood, I feel fine. But when I step outside, I definitely feel unwelcome. Some people just assume everyone in my situation is an anchor baby, like this random tall white guy at the Staten Island Ferry Terminal.
Yeah, well, people cross the border just to have their babies born here, become citizens, and then it's like they're automatically, like, grandfathered in.
Sometimes I do feel like an anchor baby, because as soon as I can, I will file for my parents' legalization. I don't want us to be separated. But at some point, when I was growing up, I admit, I was mad at my parents for coming here. I was mad that they had to work so hard, that we had to wait in line to get free food, that we had to lay low.
I know that's hard. This kind of conversation is tough, isn't it?
This is Professor Orozco. She is the co-director of immigration studies at NYU. I didn't want to spill my guts out to her. She was a stranger, but that's what I found myself doing.
It's hard watching, like, my sister, like, struggle to be something amazing. And I don't know, it just, because, like, sometimes I feel like I don't even want to go to college. My parents, they just, like, they want me to fill these, like, high expectations. And I feel like I just don't want to disappoint them. I don't know, it's just...
Your parents, like many immigrants, frame the immigration as we did it so you could have a better life. It feels manipulative from the kid's point of view. I think immigrant parents come to have a better life for the whole family, themselves and their kids included.
For a whole week, I try to get the courage to talk to my family about all the feelings I've been having. Finally, in the kitchen, I started talking. And so did they. I asked them if they came to this country so my siblings and I could be their anchor babies. They had no idea what that meant. When I explained it, my dad said he wasn't even thinking about trying to become a U.S. citizen. He just wanted to find a job so he could get money to eat or a place to live and to provide for others back home.
Para comer, para vivir, para ayudar a sus demás familiares que se quedan allá.
In the end, my parents say they don't even want to stay here. They want to return back to Mexico in 3 or 4 years. And my sister is thinking about leaving with them. I can't believe it. Without them, I would feel lost. If that's what they want, then I'll have to be okay with it. I just like to talk about it more.
That's 16-year-old Alicia Martinez. She told her story for the Radio Rookies program at WNYC. Radio Rookies teaches teenagers to report about their lives for the radio.
Early in the war in Iraq in 2003 and 2004, Brian Turner served there as an American enlisted man. He was a sergeant. Later, he left the military and became a poet. We heard his poetry on this program in 2006. And now the soldier poet has returned to Iraq, this time as a civilian. He writes about his experience in the July issue of National Geographic.
Sometimes I feel as if I'm sort of haunted by, in good ways and bad ways. There's beauty and there's also difficult times, but sort of haunted by the things that had happened before. But in a similar way, I've been sort of haunting those streets as well, going back in my mind to where I was. And I wanted to just go there and see if I could speak to actual living Iraqis and see where they are now.
Without a gun, without a uniform, without his old unit, Brian Turner simply walked the streets of Baghdad, talking to people.
Students, writers, cab drivers, welders, machinists, people at a restaurant.
It must be different to approach the place as Brian Turner, a man not in uniform, as opposed to one of a group of Americans all in uniform in a unit.
to be honest, I was afraid. I had a lot of fear that never really left. And at the same time, I did find myself doing things that I did when I was with the unit. So as I write in the article at one point, I mentioned how I started making these slow circles as I was walking along Al-Mutanabi Street where the bookseller shops are, and I found myself sort of shifting back to being on patrol. I sort of had to adapt myself to the actual time that I live in, not where I was living, because Baghdad's a new place.
Describe what you mean by that when you say walking in slow circles. Where were you? You were on a busy shopping street, a kind of bookselling street.
Right. Al-Mutanabi Street's named after a famed poet from the days of old, and there are a lot of bookshops along there, and there have been horrific attacks that have taken place on that same street, as throughout Baghdad. Basically what it is a fairly narrow lane, and on both sides there are shops, and outside there are sort of books that are stacked up on tables and on the ground on blankets. And as I was walking down the middle of this lane, I realized that every few yards or so I would do a slow pirouette turn. That's what I used to do when I had a rifle in my hand, just to see what's around you, if there's anything dangerous behind, that kind of thing.
There is a single word in your description of this that made me know that I needed to talk with you again. You said of those turning circles, "It's a habit I've mostly broken back home in the States." Mostly, after 7 years.
Yeah, there's a, how do I put it? The things that I did as a soldier, many of them I've sort of sloughed away. Like when I drive down the freeway, I don't catch myself often sort of scanning the overpasses and underneath them for people that might be above the overpass that might drop a hand grenade or shoot at us. But there are other habits that are hard to break. Like when I go into a restaurant, I often want to sit where I can see everything with my back to a wall. And I also sometimes catch myself watching mirrors to see what's, glass windows to see who's behind me, or I'll make turns, slow turns here and there. And sometimes, especially when I'm in a crowded environment.
That, depending on the person and the degree to which it happens, could be a symptom of post-traumatic stress.
I think basically there's a wide range of trauma. I'm able to lead a pretty healthy life, but there's still the baggage of war.
Did you find little symptoms of what might be post-traumatic stress among the civilian populace in Baghdad as you moved about and got a chance to talk with people?
I didn't so much. Maybe because the pressure still feels a bit ongoing. There's helicopters flying overhead. Now and then you'll hear an explosion or gunfire.
It's not post-traumatic because there's still the trauma going on, you're saying.
Exactly, yeah. But what I did find was with many people, there's a deep kind of resignation. The one gentleman, he was a machinist / welder, I guess, and I was in his shop, and he was telling me about how he felt like that things, they come in waves, and that there's difficult times now, but things will get better later, and then they'll be difficult again. And he just sort of seems to be taking the day with what the day gives him.
In conversations with civilians, some people must have offered you their opinions of the American intervention there, whether they thought it was useful or not useful.
Mm-hmm. For example, Youssef, he was one of the interpreters I was with, he said, "Man, America didn't bring," this is a paraphrase, I have it quoted in the article, but he said, "America didn't bring democracy, America brought walls, man." And he was insistent, he said, make sure you tell them that. And I came across that sentiment.
What does he mean,
walls? Often as well. Well, the T walls, the blast walls, these huge concrete walls that look like a T flipped upside down. They just line many of the roadways in Baghdad itself. And it's a city that has checkpoints every few hundred meters, it seems. In a sense, I felt as if the city was sort of on pause, and it's waiting for the walls to be taken down at some point and for the checkpoints to be removed so that they can kind of get back to their actual lives.
Brian Turner, when you spoke with us 5 years ago, I asked if you felt that by your service in Iraq that you'd made a difference. And essentially you said, no, you didn't think you had, except maybe for the soldiers you worked with most directly. Some time has passed now, and you have a different sense, perhaps, of the broader mission, and some kind of partial victory has been declared, rightly or wrongly, and there's been a substantial withdrawal. Looking at it now, do you feel you were part of anything that made a difference for the better in Iraq?
It might take another 5 years for us to get this, but I can say this. I sat with two artists in a courtyard in Baghdad, and I asked them a similar question that was related. And they talked about when the British were in Iraq in the 1920s. And they said that they had assigned a British citizen to come in and start up a bookstore in Baghdad, which is still there to this day, by the way. And through that bookstore, Edith Sitwell and T.S. Eliot came through there. And that was part of the spark that shifted Arabic verse, which had centuries of, you know, tradition behind it, and created, in part, was one of the influences on the modern Arabic free verse movement. And so, to get to the point, Sadek Muhammad, the man sitting across from me, said, you know, Brian, you brought your guns and your boots just as the British did before, but where's the other part? Where's the cultural conversation? And so I'm not sure if I did any good before, but I'm trying to figure out some way to attend to his question and see if I can be a part of that conversation.
Brian Turner is an American veteran and a poet and the author of an article in National Geographic about his return visit to Iraq. Mr. Turner, thanks very much.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
Brian Turner writes about his return to Iraq in the latest issue of National Geographic, and you can see photos of Baghdad at npr.org on the picture show. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Department of Veterans Affairs tries to make it easier for vets to buy houses by guaranteeing loans. Nowadays, there's a huge number of foreclosed homes on the market, and in many areas, those homes are the best deals. But VA loans come with lots of rules and requirements, and vets trying to use them are running into big problems. NPR's Yuki Noguchi explains.
It's in pretty much everyone's interest that someone buy up foreclosed homes. It's good for neighborhoods, it's good for banks. The economy benefits, and the buyer gets a home to live in. But buying a foreclosed home or one in short sale can be difficult, especially if you're a veteran and want to use a VA loan. Take Eric Warner. A third of the homes he looked at in Palmer, Alaska were foreclosures.
But there was no point in even looking at it because they'd tell us up front, no VA loans.
The VA and Federal Housing Administration have long offered loans designed to help veterans and middle-class buyers. The VA guarantees up to 25% of a loan, which makes it possible for buyers like Warner to put no money down. The subprime crisis gave no down payment loans a bad name. Now more vets are drawn to the VA because they offer the best deal in the market. But the VA loans require that houses must be in great condition, no repairs. In today's market, with so many foreclosures, this caveat often turns out to be a deal breaker. Eric Warner.
There's very few times that I felt embarrassed for being a veteran, but finding that in many ways it was becoming a stumbling block to securing a good home for my family was sort of shocking and embarrassing.
You might think that a bank with lots of foreclosed homes to unload might be eager for deals. But even in areas where foreclosures make up the bulk of what's on the market, realtors told me clients had trouble trying to buy distressed homes. One woman in St. Louis says her family may abandon the VA loan option because the restrictions are just too frustrating. After 5 months, Warner finally did buy a house. Did you ever consider giving up on the VA loan?
Frequently. Usually at about 1 o'clock in the morning after, 1 or 2 hours of my wife crying and saying, why is it this hard?
The irony is the VA says it created its requirements to help vets. The appraisal is the VA's way of protecting vets from sinking money into a rundown house they later might not be able to afford. Of course, normally, foreclosures are relatively rare. Today, the market is flooded with them.
We have talked among ourselves about, well, are we protecting somebody out of the home?
This is Bill White, Assistant Director of Loan Policy for the VA. White acknowledges the VA has gotten complaints about the rules, but he says the VA has no intention of changing its requirements. Emily Winslow isn't sure what to blame for having to endure 6 months of bank applications, inspections, and paperwork. During those 6 months, Winslow moved her family 5 times, from a hotel to friend's house, back to another hotel. Then, at 9 months pregnant, still waiting, she frantically searched for a rental.
And no one could accommodate us because our stipulations were so challenging. Here we were just waiting on the deal. And, you know, we have a month, maybe two, until this deal goes through. I'm having a baby in 2 weeks. Can you please help us out? And they said, no, I'm sorry, I can't.
The rental finally came through, but their offer remained in limbo. The house they wanted didn't pass the VA's inspection because of a termite problem.
We were just so brokenhearted a number of times because it appeared that the whole deal was going to fall through.
In January, Winslow's family bought a house in Augusta, Georgia. She still feels embittered by the process.
If common sense were used, we wouldn't have had to go through this. You know, maybe a wife is out there whose husband is deployed and she's going through this by herself and doesn't know what to do. My heart breaks for people like that.
Winslow says there's good intent behind the VA's rules, but she doesn't understand how there could be so many homes out there needing families when so many families need homes. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.